Okay, good evening, everybody. Welcome. It is a great pleasure to welcome everyone here this evening as we welcome Rabbi Dr. Weinreb, who's going to speak with us this evening. And although I am not officially the one who's going to introduce Rabbi Weinreb, I just have to thank him on behalf of our community. And I speak now of the greater Jewish community for all of his personal efforts and, of course, the organizational efforts and accomplishments ever since he has taken the lead and a very important role at the Orthodox Union. We are very, very much indebted and grateful to you for all that you have provided for our community. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank their sisterhood for their continuous efforts on behalf of our community and sponsoring very important, informative events of this type. And I'd like to thank this evening in particular our sponsors, Eliza Jonathan Froelich and the entire Dworkin family, and to, of course, welcome Mrs. Susan Dworkin, who's with us this evening. The last time that I had the privilege of seeing Rabbi Dworkin was the day before his Patira. And obviously it's a moment that I will never forget. And I remember that he expressed to me at the time how proud and excited he was that his children, Eliza and Jonathan, would be joining our community. And I couldn't help but think to myself at the time how excited I was that in addition to the fact that we would be getting Eliza and Jonathan, I would be able to continue to benefit from his guidance and his support. And I viewed it nothing less than a fringe benefit of all the years that I was hoping to be able to continue to benefit from his presence. And obviously, so saddened, and as we all are, that I did not have that privilege. But at the same time, how grateful we are and how happy we are that Elise and Jonathan have joined our community. Literally since the day they have arrived, they have been very active in many ways, taking leadership roles and constantly offering their support, their advice, their assistance, to me. And in this way, there's no question about it, that Rabbi Dworkin continues to live on in so many ways through his children. And I would just personally like to take this opportunity to thank Elise and Jonathan, but on behalf of the entire community, for all their efforts, and we look forward to continuing to benefiting from your all that you share with our community, please God, for many years to come.
I want to thank everyone for coming out this evening. I know it's not easy during the week. As you know, this lecture is the second in a series discussing Jewish grief and mourning presented by the Sisterhood of Beth Aaron. To investigate a topic, while it might not be so pleasant, unfortunately is one that we confront often in our lives. In fact, tonight's lecture on Nichum Avelim speaks to a mitzvah that we all do frequently, and yet how many of us know the halachot, the laws, or the rationale behind them, or can follow the spirit of the law? How many of us can appreciate Chazal's understanding of the human psyche in designing these laws and customs? Tonight's lecture will most definitely enlighten us in these areas. Before I introduce tonight's esteemed presenter, Rabbi Dr. Tzvi Hirsch Weinreb, my husband and I would like to thank Rabbi Rothwax, the Sisterhood, and Dina Yellen, who unfortunately is not here. She herself is on the way back from a funeral, believe it or not, for allowing us to sponsor this lecture in memory of my father, Rabbi Stephen Dworkin, Zichrono Livracha. We feel that this topic of comforting the mourner fits the essence of who my father was. The Midrash in Yalkut Yishayahu Taf Ayin Dal states, Darko shel av l'rachem, v'darka shel aim l'nachem. It is the way of a father to have mercy, and the way of a mother to comfort. With all due respect to the Midrash, my father must not have been the typical av they describe. Yes, he was a merachem, merciful, or a saucy, as we affectionately called him at home. As he always gave second chances, and despite your wrongdoing, you knew that he would be ready to forgive and forget, at home, with those in his shul, and rabbinic community. But unlike the Midrash, he had those motherly qualities. He was also a minachem, a comforter. As a rabbi, he was always the first one at the hospital or the shiva house or by the side of a family struggling. He was so good at providing that nechama, because as it says in Rashi Shmot Bet Yeralef, Nakhan eina velibo liyot meisar aleihem. Their pain was his pain. He truly felt it in his heart as he would sit there crying alongside of them, as anyone who knew him knew he often did. His sense of humor and the ability to cheer people up with his wit and smile were legendary. When we were sitting Shiva at his passing and people came to the Menachem us, visitor after visitor recounted where my father served as a source of Nechama for them. And so this topic of Nechama Balaam is so fitting to who my father was. As Executive Vice President of the RCA, Rabbinical Council of America, a person whom my father respected highly as a colleague and a chaver was Rabbi Dr. Zvi Hirsch Weinreb, Executive Vice President of the Orthodox Union. I recall how pleased my father was when Rabbi Weinreb took that position, as he knew how closely they would be working. It is therefore particularly meaningful that he joins us here this evening. We know how busy Rabbi Weinreb is and truly appreciate his fitting us in. Having him here is a true honor. His expertise on the topic from a rabbinical perspective and a psychological one as a clinical psychologist make him a true find for tonight's presentation. Rabbi Dr. Zvi Hirsch Weinreb has been Executive Vice President of the Orthodox Union since January 2002. As talented teacher, writer, and orator, Rabbi Weinreb was previously the spiritual leader of Congregation Shomrei Emun in Baltimore, Maryland, which he joined in January 1989. Prior to assuming the pulpit of Congregation Shomrei Emuna, in his role as psychologist, Rabbi Weinreb served as the Assistant Supervisor of Psychological Services for Prince George's County Public Schools and as Chief Psychologist of the Potomac Foundation for Mental Health. And again, in his role, merging both roles, he is also the Rabbinic Liaison for NEFESH, the North American Network of Orthodox Mental Health Professionals. And without further ado, I'd like to introduce Rabbi Weinreb.
Thank you very much for the introduction, Mr. Olich, and I want to thank you and your family for sponsoring this lecture and really for giving me an opportunity to put together some ideas anew, not new ideas, but newly organized ideas I'd like to share with you this evening. And the challenge that was set before me is to give a halachic and psychological underpinnings for the halachos of Nichum Avela. What I'd like to do, I'm reminded of a Rav that I knew in Baltimore. His name was Rav Yitzchak Sternholz, from the Vrocha, Hasidic Yid, and he had a shtiebel in Baltimore, and he had a very interesting hobby. His hobby was plagiarized sport. He was a true expert to Talmud Chacham, and he was able to detect when Sforim had been plagiarized from earlier Sforim. And what often happens in a plagiarized Sefer, and I won't share the names of some of these Sforim, but some of them are rather famous, is that the plagiarizer takes the original Sefer, and whereas the original Sefer did not quote all the proof texts, but only the person's Kedushei Torah. But the plagiarizer, in order to pad the Sefer and make it thick, copies out the whole Gemara, and the whole Rambam, and all the words of the Rishonim, and then tacks on a little bit of Kedushei Torah. So Sternholz used to say, yeah, not so bad to be a plagiarizer, because at the very least, if you study his plagiarized works, you're reviewing the Gemara, the Rambam, and everything in the process. So, tonight, what I say won't be plagiarized, but it will be my own speculation. But so that you're not stuck just with my speculation, but have something more, milach moshel Torah, something stuff. And what I want to do is just review with you the highlights of the 13th parak of the Rambam's Hilchos Eva, in which the Rambam deals with the mitzvah of Nichum Avela. I'm just going to really highlight those points which have a psychological significance, obvious psychological significance. The Rambam begins, Kesad Menachamin Neso Avela. What's the procedure for bringing comfort, for consoling the mourners? He says, after the kavura, after the burial, before the burial, there's no comfort. So when the person's close relative is lying dead unburied before him, meso muta lefono, there really is no nichum. You can't comfort somebody. It's too soon to comfort someone. And this is already a very, very important point. It's a point where the feelings are still so raw, so unprocessed, and the person is still in a state of shock, where any words of comfort would be absolutely superfluous. And when the person is supposed to be ideally totally preoccupied with basically funeral arrangements, with the details and logistics, which are relatively easy to deal with, but not yet to deal with the tremendously powerful emotions of loss, grief, often anger. So after the kavura, after the burial, is some kind of closure, and it's at that point when the mitzvah of Nichum Avelim kicks in. And the Rambam describes how that's done immediately after the kavura. We still do this today on the cemetery. People stand in a shura and give a expression of Nichum. Then the Rambam continues and describes what happens when the ovel, the mourner, leaves the cemetery and those perfunctory tanchumim and proceeds to his home. And all 7 days, bo'im b'nei odom l'nachmo, all the 7 days of avelus, people come to console him. Ha'ovel mesa b'rosh, the mourner sits at the front, sits in the focus of the group. The Ein HaMenachamim Rashoyim Leshet, and the people who bring him comfort, are not supposed to sit on comfortable chairs. Elo al gabe karka. This is the din in the Gemara. We don't practice it today anymore, but it's still the idea, the spirit, is extremely important. The comforters join the mourners. The Menachamim join the Ovel on the ground. Shenemar v'yeshvu ito la'oretz. It's interesting that in Chazal, in the Seches Moed Koton, which is the source of almost all the laws of Avelus, the passages in the Tanakh that are seemingly most relevant are passages from Iyov, from Job. Because really, what Iyov is all about is one big process of Nichum Avelim. Iyov lost his family, and he lost so much else, his fortune, his health, etc. And his friends came to comfort him. And the entire Iyov, a long, long, complex, beautiful sefer, is really the dialogue between the Menachamim, the friends of Iyov, and his responses. And Chazal learned many, many halachos from the story of Iyov. And one being that the friends of Iyov sat with him on the floor, and so too, Medina de Gomorrah, from the Talmudically, one should be sitting on the floor with the Ovel, even though we don't do it any longer. But nevertheless, to sit up in some comfortable chair while he's down on the floor on some stool is not proper. We sit on regular chairs and try to kind of lean down toward him, so at least we have some way of fulfilling Vayeshvu Ito L'Oretz. And then is a very important halacha. V'ein Rashoyim Lomar Dovo. The Menachamim are not permitted to say anything ad sheyiftach ha'ovel es piv techila, until the mourner opens his mouth first. Shenemar v'ein dover elov dover. Uchsivach arichein posach iov es pihu v'ya'an Eliphaz. In other words, Eliphaz, the friend of Iov, would not begin his words of comfort until Iov has spoken first. The very important principle here, I guess it's an important principle in all human relations, but certainly in relations with the mourner. And that is, you can't come in with your agenda. You've got to let the mourner set the agenda. The mourner may not want to talk at all. The mourner may want to talk about topics which are distracting, or which will distract him. He may want to talk about the dead. You may want to talk about the process of the death, the illness, or whatever. You have to take your cues from him or her. You can't come in with your agenda. So many of us have all sorts of ideas about what it would be good to tell this poor, aggrieved person. And we don't know. No one knows the heart of another person. And therefore we have to take our cues from the Ovel or Avelo himself. And the Kevon Shenyana Barosho, after there's a discussion going on in a dialogue, and the mourner signals by shaking his head, enough, the conversation is over. Shuv ein ham nacham im nashoyim leishay vetzlo. So you have to get up and leave. Et shelo yatrichuhu yosei amidah. So that you shouldn't bother him too much. Rambam, so sensitive, of course, these are all paraphrases from Talmudic sources, but he's so sensitive to what anyone that's been through the experience knows, that you need some private time, you need some downtime, you can't spend the whole time talking and listening to Menachemim. Often it's difficult to sit there for various reasons. People say the stupidest things. And the Rambam is telling us here, number one, wait for his leave. Wait for the mourner's leave, number one. And number two, when he signals you, non-verbally signals you, I have it, enough, then it's time to check out. Lately I've seen in some shiva homes that there are actually signs posted, come to be Menachem between 12 and 3, and between 5 and 7, which is not such a good idea, to build in some private time for the Ovel and Avela to eat, to think, to nap, or whatever. But it's also incumbent upon the Menachem to realize that this Ovel has all sorts of needs besides his Avelos, and Shelo Yatri Chuhu Yoseh Amidai. One should not bother him more than necessary. Rambam goes on to say, I'm skipping several halachos, Ein omrim shmua v'hagoda v'vesa ovel, ela yoshvin dovin. In the Beis Ovel, Torah study, even Agadic Torah, Thrushes, Vertlach, Medrash, have no place in the Beis Ovel. But rather, one sits dovin, sad, saddened, depressed, and speaks softly, etc. Last of the Divrei Torah, of course, is awesome. To actually study Torah is not permitted. Then the Rambam says something which is extremely important. Ein bochen al hames yoser mishlosha yomim. One does not cry. There are different stages to avelos, stages to mourning. Chazal knew this long before Elizabeth Kubler-Ross knew that there were stages in mourning. Chazal knew two of stages. And they knew that there was a 3 day, the first 3 days when the feelings are still bitter, the tears are still flowing. Those are the 3 days for bechi, for bechia, for tears. After that, it's time to control those tears. The maspidin, yosem nishiva. The hesped, the emotionally stirring hespedin, which were commonly given, not past 7 days for most people. To Talmidei Chachamim, according to the Erech Chochma, one can extend the period of Hesped, but for the average person, just 7 days. Then the Rambam says, Al yiskashe odom al neso yoseh midai. A person should not literally harden himself. A person should not allow himself to remain stuck in mourning too long. Shenemar, as the Pasuk says, Al tivku lo neis v'al tanudu lo. There's a point beyond which it's improper to go on, at least externally, mourning. Hamitzayar atzmo yoser al minhogo shalolom hareze atipesh. The Rambam often minces no words and says that if a person fails to realize that death, mortality, is, in his words, minhogo shalolom, that's the way of the world. People die, and people die before their time, and people die tragically and suddenly, and etc. And one has to, at some point, accept the minhago shel olam, the way the world is. And if one is not that way, but rather is mitzaer atzmo, pains himself, tortures himself on for weeks and for months and sometimes for years, harezet kipesh, he's a fool. Elokei tzad yase, he should try to follow the stages. First 3 days, 7 days, 30 days, 12 months, yortzeit. Of course, Ram doesn't talk about yortzeit, but there are specific halachic stages. That's on the one hand, being misabel too much, grieving too long, what they call these days pathological grief. On the other hand, kol mi she'eino misabel, you have people who are cold and controlled and don't mourn at all, stoic, and they just take it and somehow grin and bear it. That's not proper either, the Rambam says. In fact, someone who does that, hareze achzori, such a person is cruel. He does some highlights of the Rambam's Perek Shlosha, also a 13th Perek of Hilchos Eva. I'd like to refer back to some of these, but first offer a framework for Nichum Avelim in a very, very important stage that the Halacha does not, to my knowledge, focus on in great detail. And it really comes from what I've noticed in my experience as a pulpit rabbi. We all know that to some extent the Rabbanim are trained either by Shimush or by learning or by observing other rabbis what the process of Kfura is, and the process of Kriya, the process of Shiva, etc., etc. But what happens after the Shiva? What happens after the Shiva? Typically in our communities, obviously there are many exceptions, but typically after the Shiva, all the Menachemim go back to their own business. Very few people even think of the mourner. We may see him in Shul saying Kaddish or something, but basically, whereas during the Shiva we were there, some of us there every day, we came to the Minyonim, etc., etc. Once the Shiva is over, there tends to be a withdrawal from the Ovel. From the point of view of the Ovel, this is a very difficult time. During the Shiva, in our communities, people are coming and going. You're busy, you're somehow, there is a certain hesed hadas, a certain distraction from the pain. You're certainly not alone. People are coming back and forth, etc. You have a role to play. You're center stage, and you have some structure to your life, halakhic structure, where you can sit, what you can wear, etc. Once the Shiva is over, you're stuck, often all alone, maybe you and your spouse, with all of these feelings and nowhere to go with them. And many people are struck with this immediately after the Shiva. Some kind of takes a couple of days to sink in. But there is this post-Shiva phenomenon. And of course, any one of us who has suffered the loss of a parent, my mother, Baruch Hashem, is still alive. My father passed away, however, almost 14 years ago. And after the Shiva, of course, I experienced this aloneness, this letdown, this where to go. But periodically, to this very day, though people who have lost people, lost close relatives 50, 60 years ago, still feel this way occasionally, where I'm driving or walking, or in my case, serving at the Shliach Tzibur as a chazan, and my father was such a wonderful chazan in Baal Tzvila, that I suddenly experience the loss all over again. And I'm brought to tears. In the first few months, this is quite frequent, and often I found myself that it was sometimes dangerous for me to be driving, because I would suddenly be overwhelmed with tears on a highway going too fast. And just from the point of view of safety, it was risky. But to this very day, sometimes one is overcome when one does not expect it at all. It can be triggered by all sorts of subtle cues, and you're right back with the sense of loss. So the question becomes, what can a Menachem do? What can another person do to help the Ovel through the process of post-Shiva, immediately post-Shiva, and on for the rest of his life. And I'd like to share with you a few ideas. And one has to do with a passage I came across some time ago. And I keep coming back to this. There's something about this particular story, and as you'll see, it's a true story, that just grabs me. If you're at all familiar with the personalities of the Musa movement, so you know the founder of the Musa movement in the 19th century was Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. And he had various disciples. One of them, a man named Rabbi Simcha Zissel Ziv. He was had a yeshiva in Kelm, and he's known as the Alter from Kelm, the old man of Kelm. Most of what, at least in the times when I went to yeshiva, most of what we knew about the teachings of the Alter from Kelm were from his disciple, third generation. One of his disciples was Rabbi Yeruchim Lubavitz, who was the mashgiach in the yeshiva of Mir back in the old country. Rabbi Yeruchim was known as the Baal Musar par excellence, the master of all the skills that go into being a mashgiach in the yeshiva, spiritual guide in the yeshiva. And many people feel that Rabbi Yeruchim is the major interpreter of the Alter from Kelm. Alter from Kelm wrote very little. These days they've collected his writings from letters and whatnot. They never systematically wrote a sefer. So much of what we know of his teachings is from Rabbi Yeruchim. I imagine, and I think this is true of anybody who's familiar with these teachings and writings, that Rabbi Yeruchim must have studied under the Alter from Kelm for 20 years. Because he quotes him on every page of his writings. He quotes his Rebbe, Ab Simcha Zissel. The fact is that he was only a student of Ab Simcha Zissel for a few months. And here's the story. Rabbi Yeruchim's children write in a preface to one of his works. The Emes Shimesh of the Mori es Hasabo Kadisha Zatzal Tachos Mishona Achas. Our father, Rabbi Yeruchim, served or studied under Rabbi Simcha Zissel for less than a year. But he was able somehow to integrate into himself the teachings of his master so that it became part and parcel of his own teachings. How do we know this? Because we have a record of the Hespedim that were given for the Chofetz Chaim. Chofetz Chaim died in 1934, a very, very old man. And in Radin, the small town of Radin where the Chofetz Chaim lived, they had Hespedim eulogies every day of the Shiva. And one of the eulogies was delivered by this Rabbi Yeruchim. And Rabbi Yeruchim shares with the public, self-disclosure, with the public at the Hester for the Chofetz Chaim, the following story in these words. I want to reveal to you, dear audience, something which I never revealed to any other person all of my life. And that is, the Bacharusi Bosi Lekel. When I was a young boy, I came to Kelm, yeshiva in Kelm. Bachur Kechol Bachur Poshut. A bachur like every other bachur. A boy in the yeshiva like every other boy. And then when I heard the Rebbe of Simcha Zissel teach, a short time later he died. So I, a young boy, the body was lying in the base medrash before the Levi. And I sat behind a wall, behind the mechitza. V'yamadati shom kol hayom b'bchios u'tzaokos. And I stood there the whole day, crying and shrieking. Lo achalti v'lo shasisi. I didn't eat and I didn't drink. And I was saying to myself, remember this is a 14, 15 year old boy speaking. And he told himself, I have just begun to understand what a human being is. And what are his obligations? My eyes were just opened. When I heard you, he's dressing the dead body, I heard you a few times. You opened my eyes to so much. Here I am, a bachur, kechol bachur pashut. And you taught me so much. Kehine nistalakto mimenu. Now you're gone. Kocho amadati shom kohayom. I stood that way the entire day. Ba'argish kol yomai. And I felt all my life. She'im zikani Hashem yisporach. Lohovin o lahakir ma'at. If God has given me, he's talking now in his late adulthood, and he says, if God has granted me any wisdom, any understanding, it is because of that day. That day that I stood by the body of my Rebbe, who died so prematurely from my point of view, I gained so much from it. There's a lot of powerful messages in this little story. And it's the story of Rabbi Rucham, who was one of the greatest Nevinim, one of the greatest experts on human nature. And he understood human nature really from that first exposure, where he had this raw grief, this sense of loss, and you can even detect a certain sense of anger. I came to yeshiva, I finally found someone to inspire me. I'm a 15-year-old, that's a lot to inspire a 15-year-old, even back in the old country. And here I am inspired, and suddenly you dare to die on me? How could you do that? But out of those tears and out of that anguish, he was able to foster a connection to his dead Rebbe that lasted him for the rest of his life. Now, what he doesn't tell you here in the story is that he went on in his life, obviously, and he began to interview systematically older students of Reb Simcha Zissel, people who had studied with him years before, collected his writings. He talked to people who had interacted with Simcha Zissel. So even though Simcha Zissel died, he lived on in various ways, and Rabbi Rucham took advantage of this. What he is presenting here in this dramatic way is something which psychologists have noted a long time ago, and much has been written about it again since September 11th, etc., in the process of discussing recovery from trauma. But all grief is a trauma. It could be a 102-year-old mother who dies. I just met a woman the other night whose 102-year-old mother died a few weeks ago, and she was still suffering grief and a sort of trauma from a woman who probably was in a comatose state for 7 or 8 years. Nevertheless, the trauma is there. What happens in grief is the following. All of us have a circle of people with whom we are part of our world, our social world. Spouses, our children, our parents, our siblings, close friends. All of us also have in our minds a certain implicit script for what life is supposed to be like. Especially young people have this script. You know, you go on, you go to college, and study, and then become whatever, a doctor, a lawyer, an Indian chief, and then go on to graduate school, and be successful, and have a home, and 2 cars, and etc., and 3.6 children, and etc., etc. We all have this script in our head. And eventually, I'll grow older, my children will marry, and I'll be back at my empty nest, my wife and I, and we'll retire, and I'll have the golden years, and everything will be so wonderful, and we have this whole script in our head. Some of us in great detail, but all of us, to some extent. When something happens to one person in this little social ad, and a spouse dies, suddenly, through illness, we feel a loss, not just for the person, but the script has changed. We have lost the script that we've projected in our lives. the years down the road, the unlived years of this person, were in our mind already kind of scripted in a little bit, at least an outline. And now suddenly, you're faced with the fact that there are not going to be these golden years, and this spouse is never going to walk down the aisle by the child's wedding, or whatever. And all these things that you imagined one day happening didn't happen, and that's very traumatic, because you're losing not only the person himself or herself, but you're losing your whole sense of what your future was going to be. And it's a tremendous loss. Part of what's lost in this process is a sense of meaning. When we say that life is meaningful, that doesn't just mean that our past has meaning, but it means that we have some notion of the future that we're trying to live out. And as long as we can live that out, life feels meaningful. When one is deprived of that, then life begins to feel meaningless. Frankly, this is not about death, but it is about a different type of mourning that I'm really, literally obsessed with. Ever since a couple of days ago, the Israeli cabinet ratified the disengagement plan. And I'm not going to wax political now, but everyone will admit that the people, the thousands of people, men, women, children, old, young, who are going to be uprooted, I can use the word uprooted, who are going to leave their homes, which they sometimes built with their own hands, and their farms, and their factories, and their botechnicios, and botechnicios, and they have to leave them and go somewhere else. Under the best of circumstances, here are people who up until still are resisting the idea. Most of us still resisted the idea. But have had this idea that this is where I'm going to live the rest of my life. These four walls are going to be my shul next Rosh Hashanah, and the Rosh Hashanah after that, and the Rosh Hashanah after that. This little park is going to be where my children will play, and the child that I'm carrying will play. And there's a script that's in the mind of everyone. And now, the whole script is wiped out. And one has to redo the script. And people find meaning in life from these kind of mental projects. That's what gives life meaning. Continuity, a sense of consistency, a sense of a vision of the future. This is what gives us a sense of meaning. If one has loss, and the loss makes it impossible to continue that script, there's a tremendous loss of meaning. And one feels life is now meaningless. Of course, the closer relationship, the more intimate the relationship, the more of a sense of meaningfulness pervades. How can I go on with life without this person? What becomes necessary, and it's not easy, and it's certainly not quick, is some restoration of the sense of meaning, restoring the sense of meaning. This can't be done easily. You can't just say, okay, that person is dead, come to terms with it, come to grips with it, move on, find a new hobby or whatever. Obviously, that's trivial. But people can reconstruct a sense of meaning. Often, through trial and error, they try one kind of new lifestyle, it might work, they try another, until something fits a little bit, never totally replacing the golden dream that one had to surrender with the death of this loved one, but it nevertheless is reconstruction, restoration of the sense of meaning that begins to take place and begins to take place. Every once in a while there's one step forward, two steps back, but nevertheless, this sense of having a new coherence in life is extremely important. Most of this work can only be done by the mourner himself, herself. The Menachem, the comforter, the consoler cannot do it. However, the consoler can understand this process and stand by to help in this process in various ways. And this is what's so important. For the consoler to realize that that mourner needs to go through, and will go through one way or another, a restoration of meaning, unless the person just withdraws totally from the world and sits, and some people have done this, in pathological grief and just shuts off the world and sits there and is really a hermit. But to the extent that a person, quote, goes on living, the person begins to restore and rebuild a sense of a meaningful life, a purposeful life. And the Menachem has to understand that this process is there, and the Menachem has to encourage it, foster it, allow it, permit it, to the extent that the Menachem can. How do you do that? How does the Menachem stand by and help a mourner? There's a lesson that, I don't know about you or by Rothwax, but we never learned it in yeshiva. In yeshiva, we learned that the way to solve a problem was by talking, and that there was an answer for every question. And we were taught basically in yeshiva to talk, to argue, to persuade, to convince, to ask, to answer. We were never taught to be quiet and to listen. I don't know what your experience was, but I was never taught. You know, the fact is, whenever we were quiet and listened, we'd fall by the wayside, no one even knew we existed. However, in life, it's very, very important to learn to be quiet and to listen. Chazal, of course, are full of all sorts of advice about the importance of silence. Omotzotzi laguf tov mishtiko. Pasuk says in Mishlei, gam evil maharish chacham yechoshev. Even a fool, if he just keeps his mouth shut, will be counted as a wise person. But being quiet and listening to the other person is an exceedingly important skill in life, especially in human relations, and it's a special skill for the Menachem to learn. We saw it in the Rambam. Rambam says, don't go into the Shiva house with a script of what you're going to say. Don't have a canned message that you say. Don't come in with your agenda. Listen, keep your mouth shut and listen to the lead, let the Ovel take the lead. And when he motions or you get the sense that you've spoken enough, be quiet. The importance of being silent is extremely, extremely central. And the entire process of Nichumim, at the time of the death, certainly too soon to be Menachem, a person who's Meso Mutal Lefonov, during a Shiva, still one has to remain silent. But the same thing is true throughout the process of mourning, which can go on for the rest of the person's life. When the person is in the process of mourning, take your cues from the person, keep quiet and listen. See, let them identify what they need. And there's story after story about the power of silence and the power of just plain listening. In thinking about this talk, some of my ideas came to mind. One of the questions I asked myself was, and actually I've asked this of clients when I was in psychotherapy and members of the congregation when I was in Rabbonis, just in discussion, sometimes in the context of doing counseling, what was your first encounter of death, with death? What do you remember as being your first encounter with death? So I asked myself this question today, and maybe there were earlier experiences I had, but the one that came to mind was the death of a cousin of mine, which was a type of a crib death. No one really knows what happened, but the young boy was about 3 or 4 years old and had some type of a respiratory infection. Didn't seem to be anything serious. And then one morning, my aunt went into the room and he was gone. And of course, the entire family was shaken by it. I was maybe 11 or 12 at the time. And what I do remember is that the family decided that we're not going to tell Zaidi, my grandfather, the dead boy's grandfather, we're not going to tell Zaidi. Zaidi was an old man. When I think about it, was probably exactly the age I am now. But I look at him and remember him as being a very, very old man. And they wanted to spare him these feelings. So it must have been a Sunday, as I recall, Zevi, called him Grandpa, came to visit us and in my parents' home. And there were some other family members there, and we decided this would be an appropriate time to break the news to him. Now, this grandfather of mine was a person who studied Torah yomam v'layla. He was a shochet in upstate New York. He was a Talmud of the Pashana Rav. He's a person who was very, 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 very learned, but also exceedingly humble and self-effacing. And they broke in the news to him. They told him about it. And I remember him crying. And then he looked around and he saw me. I'm not sure exactly how old I was, but I was not by mitzvah yet, that's for sure. And he looked at me and said, "Come with me. Come here. And we went into a little study in the house, and he started talking to me and laughed about how silly the family was for not telling him the news. But he says, "I can handle it much better than them. You know, I'm an old man, I've seen such things happen, I have a whole different perspective on life." So he asked me, "How are you handling it?" You know, one of the things we don't understand at all is how children react to death, how they understand death. I mean, we just don't understand it. Believe me, I've had my share of working with children who lost a parent or a loved person and everything. They understand death differently than adults do, but just what's going through their minds, nobody knows. Maybe each kid is different. But he asked me what I was feeling. And I told him that I was wondering if my aunt and uncle, Aunt Gloria and Uncle Izzy, if they did all they could to save Simcha. Was there something they could have done? That's what I was thinking. You know, if you think of it psychologically, as a child, I felt my vulnerability, and my parents are supposed to take care of me, and so is Simcha's parents, are supposed to take care of him, and if he died, his parents weren't doing the right job. Good job. That's what's going through my mind. And it's not uncommon for children to think that way. So I said to my grandfather, you know, maybe they could have called a doctor, maybe they should have realized that this infection or flu that he had was really more serious, etc., etc. So it's very interesting. He asked me if there was a Shulchan Aruch in the house, and there wasn't that. Thinking of what Sefer would be in the house that would have just halachos, he wanted to show me. And he took out a Rav Yaakov Emden Siddur. It's an old fashioned Siddur that had everything in it. Anything you want to know is in it. All things, how you change a person's name when he's sick, all the things that you before Rothschild, you couldn't find anywhere, they were all in the Yaakov Avin Siddur. So in the Yaakov Avin Siddur, there's a list of halachos having to do with mourning, and one of the halachos he brings down is in Shulchan Aruch is that one's not supposed to say that we could have tried this, we didn't try that, etc. Why? Because that's very presumptuous theologically. You think you could defy the Ratzon Hashem. God wanted to take this boy's life for whatever his inscrutable reasons are. Nothing you could have done would have changed that. And this is the quote philosophy of the Shulchan Aruch. You shouldn't think, gee, if I would have called the right doctor or a different doctor or acted sooner or acted later or turned up the thermostat or down the thermostat or whatever, it would have helped. Because it's true, you're not supposed to try those things as long as the person's alive. But once the person's dead, there is a kind of acceptance that you have to accept this as Ratzon Hashem. And this to me was extremely, extremely powerful lesson. I will never forget it. Since then, I've always looked in the Rinach of Emel to see if I could find it. And I haven't been able to. So maybe I'm not remembering right. The Rinach of Emel is small print of many pages, so maybe it's there somewhere. But it's certainly in the Shulchan Aruch. A certain sense of Siddur Kadin, accepting the will of God and accepting it. When we talk of, I spoke earlier, importance of silence, the importance of listening. Another important thing that Menachemim do. Very, very often people ask me, "Oh, I have to go be Menachem Mobile so and so. I don't know what to say. What am I supposed to say? What can I say?" That's a great question, but there's no answer to that question. There really is no answer. And the person is certainly in the initial week of grief. There's nothing that you can say that's going to make anything any better, except one thing, and that is, I'm here. I'm here for you. So, be there. That's my answer. Just be there. Just show up. Because there is a tremendous nechama in just having people non-verbally come and be there. They say a few words, I'm here with you, call upon me if you need me or whatever. That's also extremely, extremely powerful. Now, I want to share with you a story which brought this home to me in a very dramatic way. And I'm always in a quandary, should I share the names of the people involved or not, because it doesn't reflect so well on one of the people. But I'll tell the story anyway with the people. Some years ago, I was asked to spend a Shabbos, it was actually Shabbos Chazon, before Tisha B'Av, in Shul in Cincinnati, by Balt Shul in Cincinnati. And Cincinnati, to me, was the city of Rabbi Eliezer Silver. Rabbi Eliezer Silver was this great gong. I have seen him when I was a Shiva Bocher. I heard shiurim from him. And he was on the front pages of all the rabbinic journals and wrote these learned articles and was a controversial person and was one of the first rabbis dressed like the old-fashioned rabbis to go to the concentration camps, the repatriated concentration camps right after the Shoah. Rabbi Eliezer Silver was a gong, so I asked the old men in the shul, "This is Cincinnati. I'm sure that you knew Rabbi Eliezer Silver. Can you tell me something about him that you remember?" They looked at me like I was a man from Mars. All right. So I said, "You know, Rabbi Eliezer Silver was a big rabbi in Cincinnati, etc., etc." They didn't remember him. But if you know him, who was really a big rabbi, it was Rabbi Lustig. Never heard of Rabbi Lustig. Sure was a fine rabbi, but he wasn't Rabbi Eliezer Silver. So I asked him, why was he so memorable? And they said, "Rabbi Lustig, if you were in a car accident at the other end of the city, he got to the hospital before you had a chance to call your wife. If someone died, he was there immediately at the deathbed. He took care of the Chevra Kadisha. He was there for the Kura. He was there for the whole Shiva, the Chakras, Mincha, etc. He was there. He was always there." He said, "Do you remember any of his teachings, any of his drushes, any of his speeches?" Nothing. I'd not been in shul. He was rabbi for 46 years. I was there with Hashanah Yom Kippur. I don't remember a thing. But one thing I remember, he was there. He was always there. Rabbi Silver, you know, he had a different role in life. Can't be critical of him. A different role in life. He was a Weltmensch. You know, he was a world scholar. He was out there literally saving the world, traveling to Europe, etc., etc. But in the experience of the congregant, he was not there. And Rabbi Lustig, Yizichro Boruch, whoever he was, I didn't know who he was. You know, his family, daughters. But nevertheless, he's certainly not, then made a headline, and he's not going to go down in the history books. But in the consciousness of all these people, he is far more memorable than this great Torah scholar. Again, not to cast any negative light on one or the other. They had different tafkid and different roles in life. But I saw firsthand the power of just being there. Just being there. The truth is, the conclusion, that this sense of just being there, saying nothing, but just being there, is really one of the most profound experiences that we can ever have. Because it's the experience we have every time we daven, every time we pray, we stand before God, right? He doesn't answer us, doesn't talk to us, he doesn't give us messages, he doesn't respond, he doesn't enter into a dialogue. But nevertheless, you know, everyone here knows, not every tefillah, but certainly many tefillahs, one has a definite sense that he's there. He's there, he's quiet, he's rolev, ain't no nirev. And that's the experience of Ribbono Shlom himself. And of course, Ribbono Shlom himself, one of his functions is a menachem. Ribbono Shlom is called menachem Tzion Yerushalayim. Ribbono Shlom is he who brings comfort to Tzion and to Yerushalayim. This is just some reflections on the underpinnings of certain aspects of the halachos, the halachic and psychological aspects of Nichum Avelim. I hope you found it somewhat instructive. And I want to again close by thanking Mrs. Froelich and the entire family for having the schus to stand before you today. I just want to close, finally close, with just a brief reflection on Rabbi Steve's work in Olam HaSholem. There's so much I could recall. I met him, he came to me once at some conference or other and asked me to join the RCA. He told me that you'll be part of our chevra, because I wasn't. I went to a different yeshiva than most of the chevra. And he never retreated from that commitment. Always made me feel very much a part of the chevra. And I spoke to him earlier on the day of his patira. Actually, we had a disagreement, which we never resolved. And maybe one day in a different world we'll resolve a disagreement. But when I came to Levaya and I told people, you know, it's just 3:30 in the morning, in the afternoon, I spoke to him, and here it was 8 o'clock at night, and he passed away. It's, you know how many people spoke to him that day? I mean, everybody at Levaya in terms of said, I just spoke to him this morning, I spoke to him last night, I spoke to him this afternoon, 4 hours ago, 6 hours ago, etc. Because he was really, really connected. When you talk about a person who knew what it meant to be there, that really was Steve. He was able to go beyond just being there. He often knew exactly what to say. And his facial expression itself always said a lot. But if there was one person who exemplifies what it meant to be a Menachem, it was Steve. Olam HaSholem, Yehi Zichro Baruch.